The Glasgow NeuroSociety, in association with SNI Digital, Innovation in Learning, present SNI Digital's Let's Talk, an intergenerational discussion of the ethics of new technology and lack of accessibility in impoverished areas, from a meeting held in Glasgow, Scotland, Friday, January 20th, 2023. Organized for the Glasgow NeuroSociety by Mohammed Ashraf, Hassan Ishmael, co-moderators, University of Glasgow School of Medicine. Discussion guests, Professor Matthew Walters, head of the School of Medicine, Dentistry, and Veterinary Medicine, consultant, stroke physician, and professor of clinical pharmacology at the University of Glasgow. Emeritus Professor Jorge Lazareff, Department of Neurosurgery, David Geffen School of Medicine, UCLA, Associate Director, SNI Digital. Professor Samer Hoff, Department of Neurosurgery, Neurosurgery Teaching Hospital, Baghdad, Iraq, Department of Neurosurgery, University of Cincinnati, Cincinnati, Ohio, Associate Director, SNI Digital. Professor James Ausman, Creator, CEO, SNI and SNI Digital. The discussion and questions, 60 minutes. Peer review evaluation, 5 out of 5 ranking. 25 attendees from 3 countries.
Starting the recording.
Okay, so hello everyone. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to the first Let's Talk series by Surgical Neurology International for the latest initiative, SNI Digital. This talk is in collaboration with Glasgow NeuroSociety. My name is Mohammed Ashraf, and I served as the last immediate past president of Glasgow NeuroSociety, and I'm one of the moderators for today's talk. We are one of the largest student-run interest groups for neurology and neurosurgery in the United Kingdom. We're based at the University of Glasgow Medical School, and we're affiliated and closely supported by the neurosurgical department at the Institute of Neuroscience in Glasgow. And really, we hope by beginning this podcast-style candid discussion on important issues pertaining to the practice of medicine, we can have an insightful, meaningful, worthwhile conversation by sharing our experiences and our pursuit of knowledge. The title for today's talk is Ethics of New Technology and Lack of Accessibility, especially in impoverished areas and in the developing world. I'd like to give over to my co-host and moderator, Hassan, who's going to introduce himself and hand over to our speakers.
Yeah, so good evening, everyone. My name is Hassan. I am this year's president of Glasgow Neuro. And just as my co-host Mohammed said, we are delighted to be hosting what we're hoping to be the first of many sessions looking at certain topics that are seldom spoken about in medicine. And really, this is going to be done in a podcast-style fashion where you're welcome to ask questions. And the whole point is that questions can be forwarded to these, you know, to a panel of experts, and things can be openly talked about. This session will also be posted on SNI, so keep your eyes peeled there. And at the end, we're also going to be posting a feedback form in the chat. 3 questions just asking about your thoughts about our first session and whether you've got any suggestions for ourselves on how to improve. But without further ado, I'm going to hand over to our speakers so they can give a brief introduction to themselves. And we have a really fantastic lineup of 4 powerhouses. And after that, we'll get going with the evening. Professor Ausman, if I can hand over to you first.
Well, I'm a neurosurgeon. I've been also was trained as a pharmacologist. I didn't tell you that, Matthew. But headed 2 departments of neurosurgery and been a professor in 4 medical schools or around the country. Started a journal called SNI, Surgical Neurology International, and we're starting this new format that the Mohammed and Hassan and his group is actively participating in, called SNI Digital, which is a open form of discussion of controversial topics.
I'll jump in next, if I may. Good evening, everyone. Lovely to see you all. Particular thanks to Mo and Hassan for pulling this together with Jim's help with his organization. So my name is Matthew Walters. I'm proud to be the head of the School of Medicine, Dentistry and Nursing at the University of Glasgow. In the interest of full disclosure, I'm not a surgeon and you wouldn't want me operating on you in any capacity. I'm a physician, clinical pharmacologist, and I work in the acute stroke unit of the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital where I treat stroke patients, unsurprisingly. So that's me. Nice to see you all. Looking forward to the conversation.
I am Jorge Lazarev. I congratulate the organizers. I congratulate you all that bravely are participating in the beginning of this, something that will continue to grow, absolutely certain. My experience, I was a chair of pediatric neurosurgery for 20 years at UCLA. Many other countries before. Now I am centered on the education or change of information with low and middle income nations. And one strong interest in the subject that brings us all together today, which is the distribution of resources. Welcome all, and I am extremely grateful for being part of this.
I'm Samer Haas. I'm a neurosurgeon. I have a practice in Iraq. I do vascular neurosurgery, both open and endovascular, and I have experience with trauma, like 10 years in neurosurgery. And now I'm based in postdoctoral in Cincinnati, USA. And I'm very happy to be part of this well-esteemed. And thank you, Hassan and Mohammed, for this invitation for sure. And yeah, let's learn together.
That was fantastic. There we go. A real all-star lineup of everybody from the fields of surgery, medicine, stroke. And what we're really hoping for, like I said, is some really interesting chat. And without further ado, I think we'll get the show on the road. Before we can begin and talk about the main meat of our topic, which is ethics and new technology, we have to briefly, first of all, talk about the stepping stone towards that, which is evidence-based medicine. And I'd like to direct the very first prompt towards yourself, Professor Walters, where evidence-based medicine has received some criticism from individuals about how potentially it's making medicine a bit too regimented. Could you briefly just first of all tell us a bit about evidence-based medicine and what your thoughts on it are?
Absolutely. Well, evidence-based medicine, off the top of my head, is it's the conscious and judicious use of medicines informed by the best available evidence that we have. It is taking that simple definition, I think, an entirely rational and certainly the most easily justified method of delivering clinical care by conducting clinical trials, by identifying what the best treatment options are for individual patients, and by applying those patients judiciously, thoughtfully, and with the consent of the patient. You're right that I think it can lead to a perceived restriction in the freedom of clinicians. And I think we can understand that if we look back at the history of medicine and how decisions were historically made. Evidence-based medicine is a relatively new phenomenon that was certainly empowered by the developments in technology in the 80s and 90s that enabled very rapid searching of databases to extract literature and to make sure that you could distill the key messages from the big clinical trials that had been done. Most of the people on this screen are far too young to remember what I had to do, and I suspect my fellow panelists, when we were trying to do a literature review in advance of starting a study, we would have to go to this enormous wall of the library that was covered in the Index Medicus, and we would have to look for each individual year, we would have to search on a paper, on paper, the papers that were relevant to our search. And then we'd have to go and find them physically and then pay 10 pence for each sheet that we photocopied in order to generate our literature. Now, you guys at the click of a button can have it all on your screen within a couple of nanoseconds. So evidence-based medicine was a difficult thing to do in the early days. And the alternatives were far less attractive in a scientific sense. There was what was known as eminence-based medicine, which was the most senior person on the ward round decided what was done, and that was it. There was the sort of consensus-based medicine where, you know, people would sit around and decide what the best treatment would be, and they would do it that way. There was the sort of convention-based medicine. Well, we've always done it that way, and why would we want to do it any differently? So evidence-based medicine was disruptive, and I think people objected to it to an extent because it did constrain them and it led to the development of guidelines. There are issues, and I don't want to talk too long about this, there are current issues with evidence-based medicine that can really only be applied where there is evidence. So there is still room for the art as well as the science of medicine, and experienced clinicians can still have to make choices on the basis of a lack of evidence or information to guide those decisions. But I would say, as a professor of clinical pharmacology and someone who does clinical trials for a living, that those clinical trials are good things, and the development of good, informed clinical guidelines probably serves everybody's interests, and I think advances the development and delivery of healthcare. I've said enough, I think. I'll stop at that point.
Hassan, I think Jorge has talked about ethics to people around the world and in evidence-based medicine. Jorge, do you have any thoughts on that subject?
Yes, I mean, I certainly add to what Dr. Walters, Professor Walters just said. The problem, on it's not problem, but the one of the issues with evidence-based medicine that created a very high standard that is not always possible to achieve by everybody. So everybody gets may get responded or dismissive of the evidence-based medicine because you don't have the means, the technical means to achieve that perfect diagnosis or the perfect the solution, no? And I wonder if it shouldn't be an effort from evidence-based medicine in bringing down to the core essence, independent of the technology that you use to reach such a diagnosis, no? To be brief, in the neurosurgical field, The evidence-based medicine says that any subarachnoid hemorrhage for an aneurysm should be clipped in the first 48 hours, I think, no, to prevent vasoconstriction. I mean, Dr. Osman will actually be more detailed. But there are countries where those things cannot be done because the patient is far away, as Summer may know, and the patient comes 7 days after. So what you do with a 7 days after patient, no? So the evidence-based medicine transformed more into a medicine-based evidence, in the sense the individual in Nicaragua, just to put away, okay, his patient does not fill the criteria stated by evidence-based medicine, no? So I wonder if it shouldn't be, and with this I actually finish, an evidence-based medicine that aims at going to the core of the issue rather than to the details of things that you have to do in order to achieve a perfect diagnosis, no?
Oh, definitely. What about yourself, Dr. Samir? Any thoughts from your point of view? I know, you know, evidence-based medicine is perceived differently, you know, depending on the person. And do you have any opinions on it?
Actually, I'm listening and have many thoughts and examples. Yeah, and I want to share just a situation when, just to continue the example approved by Professor Lazarev, that if you are thinking of ethics and new technology, and I think the on practice, you will find an additional joint, which is who decide is that ethical or not, and what are the situation behind that derive the whole process. As Professor Lazarev said, that if you have a patient and you have limited resources, and for example, I can give only from situation that I have been, that I am a neurosurgeon, and I know this is not exactly as the, let's say, as the guideline, but I'm obligated to, maybe because of limited resources, maybe sometimes because of I don't know, cultural limitation that something will be accepted in this part of the world, something it's not the same. It's not even, I think, the patient consent, patient understanding of, let's say, potential complication and outcome. There's a huge difference in that concept. This is from one side, and from other side, if I'm thinking of a new technology, I just pop in my mind the new technology for chat GTP and its auto writing of papers within few milliseconds. I have just experienced that a few days ago. It's just, I don't know. I paused and I think, wow, this is artificial intelligence, and I ask the chat GPT that can you write about posterior petrosal presigmoid retrolabyrinthine approach, which I know that very few people understand this, and I have like 300. Words within, I think, 4 seconds, very well written on that topic. And I just, wow, now what's this? This is an author, and I think Nature just shared something about that, is that there's a huge dilemma on what's the ethics behind that. And in some paper, the ChatGPT, which is artificial reality, used author, are included as a co-author, and people is what will be the future. And yeah, that's my initial thoughts.
That's a really interesting point, actually. And for those who are unaware, just so everyone's in the same boat, ChatGPT is this fantastically new AI that was recently released. And whilst it can do practically anything you ask it to, an aspect that has been used in the scientific world is to help with writing, to help with publication. And as an example of its power, some people have written papers and showed that, in fact, this AI is capable of passing the USMLE without any problems. And it's just an interesting topic, and quite an interesting segue, potentially maybe even the topic of a future talk. That's an interesting thing in its own right.
But that gave us, and I don't want to interrupt, I mean, I hope somebody jumps into this as well. You can ask GPT, okay, what's the best treatment, or give me the analogy of the best treatment for a particular condition, and it will come. But that best treatment over there is not necessarily applicable, no? And
true.
So are we putting the horse in front of the cart? I did take a course in anthropology here at UCLA, Neuroscience for Social Sciences. And I say to the students that the objective of you being here and you being in depth every day, because you are in depth, the students, is to learn something, how to face the world, not to get an A. And that the GPT allows you to get an A, but doesn't teach you how to face the world. Similarly, if we put on the GPT the best evidence, yes, it's fantastic. I think that has to be a temple where the best possible evidence is collected, analyzed, and thought, agreed upon or disagreed. I agree 100% with the Professor Waters that we need to have this, like a GPT over there, a perfect GPT that is evidence-based medicine. But we also need to have the understanding how to jiggle and wiggle with the evidence in the situation that we are on, no?
Can I make a 2 minutes of comments? I think for me, evidence, and I think Professor Walters wants to follow me, but the question is, what is evidence? Evidence are observations that are made by humans on certain phenomena. And therein lies the problem. There are isolated facts that are proved to be 100% accurate. There are phenomena that occur that various people interpret. They don't have to all interpret them the same way. And then the question is, they're labeled with the word evidence. Well, evidence means a lot of different things. For example, you can have evidence-based medicine. There are studies which Professor Walters know and the neurosurgeons know. In neurology and neurosurgery, there was a study done some years ago, which was a randomized controlled trial evaluating a surgical procedure and whether or not it'd be helpful in stroke. The problem turned out to be that the people who were running the study came up with a result that others disagreed with. They disagreed with the conclusion from the evidence. And they formed a special committee to go back and investigate that. The committee found could not reproduce the same evidence from the primary center on three different visits, which meant they can't produce the same evidence, which meant the conclusion is in question. Yet everyone, because it was backed by the government, went ahead and adopted the conclusion of the study, which stands today, some 30 years later, of without being challenged, and has changed the face of medicine. So the question is, when you're talked about evidence-based medicine, I think the first thing you have to do is not abandon your brain, is to analyze yourself. What is the evidence? What are the facts that leads to the conclusion so you can make that decision yourself rather than accept it necessarily from someone else? We've been brainwashed to believe that randomized control trials are the gold standard of medical observation. I don't agree with that. I think randomized control studies, and I agree with the professor that in pharmacology, many other specialties in medicine can be, if conducted properly, very, very illuminating. But you've just seen in the virus work and the vaccine work in your country and our country that there were a number of studies. Some were not even randomized controlled. Some was adopted on the basis of evidence that no longer seems to be valid, and conclusions were made on that basis. Some of the randomized controlled trials were corrupted. So the challenge to you as a physician, as a student, is to use your mind, use your brain, and question, what is evidence? What is the basis for your telling me this is evidence? And maybe you'll disagree there. But I think I agree with the professor. Ideally, yes, we need to get properly accumulated evidence, properly validated facts, and properly run studies to come to a reasonable, proper conclusion.
Absolutely.
Yes, Walter, do you have any closing marks? Yeah.
Well, I mean, just to sort of fully endorse what Professor Aspin has just said, I think it's absolutely right. There is the best that we've got at the moment. I think the consensus view in clinical academia is that meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials provides probably about the most reliable evidence that we have. But there is a real caveat there, which exactly as Professor Aspin has said, we need to question everything when we're reviewing the literature. We need to identify our own patients in the literature in order to be sure that what's being said is applicable to us. And then, of course, there's the other question about whether the technology that's being evaluated, if it is shown to be efficacious, is available to us. And that really is the nub of, I think, the broader conversation that we're going to have. It might be helpful just very quickly to put some numbers around that, because there is, to my mind, a shameful statistic in clinical medicine and in medical research, which is that it is said that approximately 10% of global health research, in terms of financial support for global health research, is devoted to the conditions that account for 90% of the global disease burden. So what you find is the illnesses that disproportionately affect those wealthy countries are studied in exhaustive detail, and minor incremental advances are potentially made, whilst in the background, there are large numbers of people in societies that perhaps don't have the money to pay for new treatments, whose disease burden is not being as rigorously assessed and alleviated. And that, to my mind, is a shocking statistic.
Wow.
And actually, that's a very important sort of segue into our next point. I want to direct this question at all the panelists. Professor Walters mentioned that a lot of the conditions that make up the global sort of burden of disease aren't given their due priority. One such entity is traumatic brain injury or head injury management. And just to sort of jump off that, I want to ask you guys that me and Hassan had the sort of perception that a lot of the research we see being done in the UK in the US is focused on sort of new technology, a lot of expensive technology that's inaccessible. But in fact, we know that research can and should be done to look at simple interventions to design robust, well-conducted trials on simple aspects of management. From a neurosurgical example, it could be, say, hinge craniotomy, just knowing whether you should leave a gap between the bone when you close it or not. But something that's simple and easy and can make a big difference and can be incorporated to a disease that's affecting the entire world. We just don't see that much research going on in those areas. And we sort of wanted to ask you guys what your opinion is about that. And is there really too much disproportionate emphasis on expensive technology that may or may not prove to be efficacious?
Yeah, I think that you address an important point about it, and I am stealing this from the gym. The thing is, we are still seeing in the way that we are talking, and when I say we, no, I don't say we are at the talking is the what we shall do for them. My effort in the last 10 years with a tiny bit of the results is allow them to do their own research and develop their own the research. I gave a series of lectures on mechanism and causality and how to write in Nicaragua, and I say dengue is a chronic condition in Nicaragua, particularly in the Atlantic coast. But the guidelines for dengue about treatment that they are following were written in Australia, where they also have dengue, which is good. And there is a very good guidelines, no? They were published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine. But I say, where are your experience in telling us what to do with dengue? I gave an example of the suppose or an example in pediatric neurosurgery. We close the spina bifida in the first 24 hours, ideally or 48 at the most. But there are countries where they have to close it 7 days after, 10 days after, because the patient comes. Okay, what is that the literature from them telling us what they have observed? No, so to summarize, I think that our way of perhaps helping reverting this thing is encouraging the work by different clinicians, researchers in different countries to actually tell us, okay, what can be done. And that data can be incorporated with the professor, the Matthews, Walters. Matthew is the first name. I just abuse of the confidence with the Professor Walters to actually say, yes, we have evidence that the best thing is in 24 hours, but we also have evidence that if the patient comes 7 days after, this is the, or those are the different sets that are important. Dr. Hausmann mentioned the issue of the vaccine. Yes, there are controversies and issues about this, but where are the papers or the suggestions by those who oppose the current state of the belief? No, so my point again, just to summarize, is this: if we think that there is a disparity, we have to find the ways of encouraging those who see those differences to tell us what are their solutions to those problems. I finished.
Does your colleagues in the audience have any questions?
There was a question that actually came through to me, and the person was actually asking quite an interesting question. What they wanted to know was basically the way they've worded it. Hold on, because it's worded a bit strangely. It says, when it comes to accessing certain resources, some are expensive or large enough that they require moving patients to central sites. Does that not in itself hinder accessibility, where potentially rural individuals who live far away from accessing these might not be able to make use of potentially new technologies?
That's right. And I don't know. I said that's right, and I leave that to the callers to answer now.
I'm happy just to say a brief word. It's an excellent point, and it is a very real challenge for us, particularly those of us who deliver clinical care out with kind of urban, the sort of high density, high population density centres. There are some ways around that that it's much easier for physicians than for surgeons. So, for example, we have a telemedicine link with some of our more remote centres that enable us to deliver thrombolytic therapy, so an old-fashioned acute treatment for ischemic stroke. And we do that over a far broader area than would be possible if we had to physically be present in the same room as the patient when the treatment was administered. So we will be able now to use telemedicine, and this is being used in many parts of the world, so the doctor can review the patient, can review the imaging remotely, and make a decision to inform the local team's management of the patient with regard to delivery of thrombolysis or not. It's not ideal by any means. There is it reduces that episode of clinical care to sort of one binary decision, when in fact there's a lot of subsequent management that needs to be done. But telemedicine is one way of improving or removing some of the barriers to high quality healthcare provision when delivered across a very large area. So that's one example of how we can mitigate it, but it remains a big challenge for us.
Samer, do you have any questions or thoughts?
Yeah, while waiting for the younger questions, I'm thinking that I can give example and have your thoughts, especially for the attendees here, based on our experience with Professor Osman and Professor Lazarev. I want to share 2 points. The first point is that I'm practicing in Iraq. I'm doing vascular neurosurgery and just graduated. All of a sudden, I found very crucial question. Do I need to do the clipping urgent? Obviously, based on the neurosurgical basic knowledge that, yeah, you should do, if the aneurysm ruptured, have patient have subarachnoid hemorrhage, you must treat the patient as soon as possible. At that point, I starved to search for any evidence that support this particular information, that if you have such patient, you should treat directly. Okay, why? Because there is nothing about that in the guidelines in Iraq, basically. So I cannot practice this on my patient. So I have patient in the emergency. I have nothing to support that I can operate it now as an emergent case or urgent case. Right. So I get to the guidelines. Every guideline say that, yeah, it should be operated as soon as possible. But there is nothing that obligates people that you should operate in the first or second day. And that was very huge, because if I have any evidence that I should operate in the first or second day, this will be my evidence with the anesthesia, so I can operate at night. The surgery may take 8 hours or 7 hours or maybe 12 hours. So if I don't have such evidence, how I convince people? And the bottom line of this example is that I see, and I think some of the team, we are observing that our patient dying. At some point, I go to the head of department, I say that I have 9 patients of ruptured subarachnoid hemorrhage died within the last 2 months waiting for surgery, waiting for elective clipping of aneurysm rupture, cerebral aneurysm rupture, brain aneurysm, but they are actually not elective cases. They should be operated on the first day, maximum on the second day. His answer say that if you have something as an evidence that you should operate on the first or second day, bring it to me. I couldn't find this. With all like 80 years of people working on aneurysm and evidence, because we cannot include everything in the guideline, and if I try to call people everywhere, I found this is a common sense that I have 5 admitted patients of ruptured aneurysm waiting for surgery. And any neurosurgeon say, what? Waiting for what? I said, okay, maybe 1 week, 2 weeks. And 50% of people, that's the evidence. If you wait 1 month, there 50%, there's a chance of mortality for those patients. So it was a huge dilemma. And I was back and forth between guideline and local application, guideline, local application. I couldn't help it. So that's how important the evidence, and that's how, let's say, the resource limitation may have extra needs.
I've just had a question come up in the chat from one of our colleagues, and I think Professor Walters, this might be sort of directed towards you. Someone has just asked that, one, given that how the UK is probably one of the most developed Western countries that still doesn't have a thrombectomy service for stroke, and there's all these new evidence and papers coming out about sort of these new endovascular devices, pipeline devices, sort of flow diverters, and these new embolization devices, and they aren't even established to be efficacious. How do you sort of take that into account when delivering the stroke service here? And is that kind of a disservice right now to our patients?
Oh, gosh. How long do we have? 20 minutes? No, you're right. I have to say, there are huge frustrations in being a clinician generally. We're optimistic. We're willful people as a profession generally. And there's an awful lot we want to achieve, to do. We're very driven, and we get very frustrated as a community, as a profession, when we are thwarted in those good intentions by bureaucracy, by lack of resource, and so on and so on. Now, clearly, it's far worse in other parts of the world, and this is what we're discussing. But yeah, my own personal story and that of my colleagues of frustration with regard to the delivery of a thrombectomy service it's enormously difficult. We have windows of time during the day when we can deliver the service, but if a patient is admitted out with those windows, then we really struggle to deliver the quality of care that we would that we would hope to do. What we do about that is, we've been advocating, we've been pushing as hard as we possibly can, but it remains a source of immense frustration that we still, as a ostensibly developed 21st century forward-looking healthcare service, are still on many occasions delivering 1990 standard care with systemic administration of thrombolytic drug, but without the ability to intervene in as many patients as we would like to do. We're hearing that things are moving, that we're beginning to win the arguments, and that there will be a sustainable service in the near future, but in the meantime, it's very difficult to do this job because you are seeing patients whom you feel could potentially benefit, who perhaps are not being given the treatment that would be better for them. So in many ways, that does give something of an insight into how it feels in other parts of the world that perhaps have even fewer resources than we do in the UK, where they feel that way more often about more conditions. And it's a very uncomfortable place to be as a physician or a surgeon.
Absolutely. Any thoughts from the rest of our panelists on that?
Yes. I think the fundamental question that's being asked is, if you are from a low to middle income country, or you don't have enough money or resources, are you going to be practicing medicine that's inferior to that in the high income countries?
Well, that's a good point.
Or do you need technology in order to practice good medicine? The answer to both of those questions is no. The greatest advances in neurosurgery, and I'm sure in neurology, have come from people outside the high income countries, in developing countries where they have creative people, innovative ideas, and they pursue them and they become successful. The first carotid endarterectomy was done in Brazil. The first coronary bypass was done in South America and Argentina. So I think people have been brainwashed to believe if you have a lot of money that you're going to come out with a good result and it's better than anybody else. And the question then is, what is the evidence that proves that? And the answer is there isn't a lot. Now, I'll give you a practical answer. I was taking care of a patient some years ago. He was a farmer, and he had a glioblastoma. That's a malignant brain tumor. We operated on him. We removed as much as we could. And then the choice came at that time. It wasn't much chemotherapy. It was, should he have radiotherapy? He lived 3 hours away. He would have to travel 3 hours back and forth to the hospital every day to have radiation therapy. And that's during the best time of his life, because the life expectancy was between 6 months and a year. So here is a country that had the most abundantly available technology, but it made no sense to use that for that patient. And so that gets us out of the idea of the technology and the science. And that is, we have to deal with patients. Those patients are our brothers, our sisters, our family members, our neighbors, our friends. What is the practical decision we want to make for you? And Samer Hose is on a panel we had at SNI Digital with some very high-powered people from the United States and elsewhere, talking about the advances they were making in traumatic brain injury. He presented his work from Iraq, and one of the panelists turned to him. He was from Johns Hopkins. He was a critical care specialist and said, "We can't get the best results like you have. What is the message? You don't need to be in a rich country to do good work and get good results. You've been brainwashed to believe that. That's not true." So, and we don't know technologically how much of this is valuable. There are all kinds of technology being promoted for spine surgery. There's not a shred of proof any of those things are valuable, not a shred of it. And they don't want to do a randomized controlled study because it would be against the manufacturers. And that gets into money. So I think it gets back to using your common sense, which you're born with, which your family taught you, and looking at things from that point of view. People in high-income countries make stupid mistakes. They also do good things. But it doesn't mean because you're in a low-income or middle-income country, we can't do that. In the UK and the USA, we have very high levels of healthcare. You can't tell me, and I can't tell you, that every single person in our country has access to that care. It doesn't exist. Well, the professor said that. Are we a backward country then? Well, yes, in some ways we are. Can we practically provide this care to everybody everywhere? There are many factors that go into that. He mentioned that.
In one thing that we were saying, going along with Dr. Osman was saying, is that yes, and Ronald with Summer, the fantastic job of evidence-based medicine, which is a fantastic job, and I think that has to be a depository of all the human analysis that has to be constantly changing. No, it's not fixed, right, Professor? I keep on saying Matthews, but it's Walters, Professor Walters. I mean, we have a thing that has to be constantly changed. What was evidence-based medicine last month may have switched a little bit better today, no? And but the idea that many of my colleagues in the so-called developing nations in Africa and in Central America have is that if you don't reach that standard, then better hide your the results. That if you didn't do the procedure or follow the rules perfectly well, you are doing something wrong. We are putting the cart in front of the horse, no? As Dr. Osman was actually saying, if people can actually say, no, you are forbidding or impeding your patient to have radiation therapy, you are doing something wrong. No, you are not doing something wrong. It's the dynamic of the evidence-based medicine allows or should allow for all this stretching of the boundaries, no? And I transmit to my patients, to my students, that evidence-based medicine is not that if you come to at the conference, you should wear a $2,000 suit to be listened to. No, you just need to have properly organized slides and ideas. You don't need to have a latest Apple computer to write at a good paper. You need to have a computer, no, to actually type. And that's a small problem I see in developing nations with evidence-based medicine, that they feel ashamed, in quotation marks, of not being able to reach that standard.
Any more questions, Mohammed or Hassan, from the audience?
Yeah, actually, there's a beautiful one that actually details about this, and it might be a controversial one, where someone's asking, is there a bias where developed countries' research is taken more seriously than that from less developed countries?
Yes.
And I think that's actually an interesting point.
Don't finish. Yes, there is a bias. There is a bias. And against that bias, Dr. Hausmann is fighting with Surgical Neurology International. I'm in the editorial board. And I wish I had that reference of the paper, because I read it many, many years ago. And I say, okay, I will find it. Well, no, didn't find it. There was a group of doctors from Mexico. They sent a paper to a journal, a clinical journal from Mexico. They were rejected. So they paired with a colleague from Johns Hopkins, and they sent the same paper with the same data. Of course, they have to admit that it was a lie after, no? Instead of being the Instituto Nacional de Neurología, was the Johns Hopkins Baltimore blah, 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 hospital, and the paper was accepted. Yes, there is a bias. Maybe less, maybe more, but there is a bias. I do remember talking to Chinese colleagues. In China, they have experience. If we have 50 patients, they have 5,000. Yep. In any statistics that you want to actually find. And I was saying, why you don't publish this? Oh, you will not believe us. They will dismiss it. Yes, there is a bias. Absolutely.
And what follows from that in a pharmacological context is that you know, if you don't have the evidence in particular populations, so for example, the Sino-FDA wants to see evidence of drugs working in its particular population, because there may be some pharmacological differences in how drugs are handled between different populations, that can go on to impede the acceptance of new drugs, new treatments, and ultimately further disadvantage the countries that are already disadvantaged to begin with. So there are quite significant practical implications which we need to address.
I'll just add a quick comment here, and that the answer is resoundingly yes. I went to a meeting of editors of journals. It happened to be neurosurgery and neurology journals, and that question was brought up by the audience. Almost unanimously on the panel, if a paper came from outside the developed world, they may read it once, or they may just reject it out of hand. The fundamental basis of the question you're asking is there bias, inherent bias, among people who claim to be scientific and objective people in dealing with information? And the answer you just heard is yes. For example, there are a number of articles, and there are prominent journals, Lancet, Nature is another, New England Journal of Medicine, and JAMA, that refuse to publish the evidence that Dr. Lazar was talking about the vaccines. Or if you practice in a hospital, you're not allowed to understand this information. Recently in California, if you didn't tell what the government told you with the right treatment, you could have your license taken away. So you're entering a world that has inherent, there is bias in every different way. And how do you deal with that? You have to understand it. You have to know it. You have to think about it. You have to judge it for yourself.
And if I could also make a quick comment about this, that obviously there's a triad between academia, industry, and clinicians. How do you guys propose that those sort of sitting at sort of the top of the chain in a position to influence policy address this? you know, obviously industry is always going to be motivated by profit, by financial interest. So is there a middle way where sort of those in academia and clinical practice can sort of push or almost lobby them to dedicate some amount of their resources to the developed world, to the developing world, to underserviced areas, you know, sort of push their hand to be charitable, for lack of better wording? What do you guys think?
Well, if I may, Mo, just I'm going to say something provocative because it's a Friday night and we're in Glasgow.
Please.
Well, if you look at, you know, 50 years of Soviet rule across Eastern Europe, zero new drugs emerged from that. I don't know about surgical techniques, that might not be the case, but in terms of the in the absence of a commercial imperative, it would appear, for whatever reason, certainly drug discovery, drug development is very difficult. It's not an environment that fosters that sort of intellectual endeavor. Having said that, I think there are some reasons to be a little more optimistic now within, certainly again, in the context of drug development. The relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and the academic centers is beginning to change a little bit. And that what I take some hope from is that there's a much greater focus now on meaningful impact of research done by higher education institutions in the UK. We used to be judged just on the number of citations our papers got, but now it's much more about the actual meaningful difference that is made. And if you're developing a 15th similar blood pressure drug that might confer modest incremental benefit in 1 in 1,000 patients who, you know, react to the other drugs, you know, that's pharmacologically or potentially of interest, but the impact is very small. Whereas if you're doing something that will make a meaningful difference globally, and you're investigating a more, you know, a technique that could be applied worldwide rather than just exclusively in a developed nation, then, you know, the way UK policy is shifting at the moment, that will attract more funding and more kudos for the institution. And vice chancellors and the heads of universities in the UK are encouraging their researchers to think more deeply about the impact of their research before getting stuck into it. So it's a small ray of light in quite what is still quite a dark tunnel.
And I've got a quick question on the point you made about metrics. So as you said, it was all about number of publications or citations. Citations are a very good metric for, say, something like basic science, but they might not be the best metric for clinical practice. You know, vast majority of people would be in the clinical, practicing clinical medicine would be in the developing world. So they might not cite your research, but they might find your paper incredibly valuable. Do you think the shift has also been made towards these alt metrics?
Personally, Mo, yes, I think it hasn't happened yet, but I think it's on the way. I think increasingly we're being asked to provide evidence, not only that our papers are being cited highly, but also that what we're doing is impactful and that people are, you know, benefiting from the work we do. That's not exclusively in medicine. That covers engineering and, you know, all the disciplines that universities do. And I think it's a good thing.
In the clinical medicine also is sometimes the clinicians who read the papers do not publish, but they change their practice based on the paper that they read. So they not necessarily meant Surgical Neurology International and maybe many other journals. When you look at the paper, it says the number of times that the paper was read or at least downloaded, or the PDF read or downloaded or accessed, no? And that is also is a valuable but intangible way of determining the efficacy of blood pressure controlling drug, say, for example. Many clinicians in Scotland are using that new evidence, but that is not translated until many, many years after, when they say, oh yeah, really, it made a difference. But by then, the academic the career of many perhaps was deranged or not properly fueled, no? Oh, you wrote a paper that was cited only 5 times. Yeah, it was cited 5 times, but the drug I was proposing is being used by thousands of people.
Ms. Rossman, do you have any comments on that?
No, I don't. I just want to just tell the audience one thing. You have to sit back and think about what goes on in society. Surgeons like to do surgery. And they approach a situation, many, I'm not saying everybody does, looking for a surgical answer. If you go through the papers in the literature today, there's always a new variety of some technique on which you can use to operate on a patient. I don't think that's great advance in science, because you can probably do a similar operation in a country that doesn't have all those resources, get the same or better results, and do extremely well. I think the drug companies look to make money. And academia, obviously people come with an orientation that, from an academic orientation, you have to be educated in medicine and follow this principle in order to be intelligent and smart, and you got to go to college. You will meet many people in your life who don't go to college who are extremely smart.
Yeah.
And so it basically, those things have nothing to do with it. It has to do with common sense, the use of your abilities and talents to the very best you can, wherever you are in the world, to come up with solutions to questions you might have that are reasonable. Samer, what do you think of that?
Yeah. generally, I agree with that. Practice-wise, I can see even the point already flagged by Professor Walter about the telemedicine and the application. I think at some point, let's say there is a solution in the middle between the two extremes or the two pushing factor. For example, I don't have guideline, but one of the solution to many things related to endovascular practice in Iraq, which is at some point related to companies, as you know, there is a lot of supplies and it's very costly. And it's not available on governmental hospital. And the teleproctoring, actually, we get teleproctoring from one of the professor in Saudi Arabia. He's trained in Canada. And that for us, at least we are, we think that we are now more ethical. We are not practicing based on direct decision, just a situational decision. Nor we have the let's say the customized guideline that we can practice on. So that telemedicine thing was very helpful and I think game changing.
I actually have a really interesting question here in the comments. Oh, and actually, I think Professor Walt was just addressing it, but I think it's actually a really interesting one. I think it would be at least an interesting one, actually, just for discussion's sake.
Yeah.
And the question is actually, it's an interesting talking point. Do you reckon a potential solution could be to mandate research alongside medicine to ensure medical research is constantly being advanced? And that's actually a really interesting point. Does anybody want to go first?
For everyone's benefit, Professor Walters, could you say that to the audience as well, your answer?
Sure, yeah. I'm just really reflecting in my answer that's written on the screen there on my own experiences when I, many, many years ago, when I was a young doctor doing research. At that time, if you wanted to work in a big teaching hospital, you had to do a doctoral degree. And so everyone had to take time out of their clinical training in order to pursue research. What that meant was it diluted the amount of research money that was available because everyone had to do it. And it meant there was a whole bunch of people who weren't particularly bothered about research, but just wanted a nice job in the teaching hospital when they finished their training, that they were, you know, doing it, although their hearts weren't fully in it. It wasn't the best model to my mind. I do think that we need to make sure that all medical graduates, and it's our job as medical educators to inculcate in all of our students an understanding of how research is done. And in order, as Jim was saying earlier on, to really empower them to question what they read and to come to their own conclusions. It's hard to do that unless you have an understanding of the scientific method and process. So that is the way I would prefer to do it, and leave the research to those who actually really want to do research. We've moved that way in the UK in the last decade or so, and I think that's a better model.
I think you have to remember that probably most of the physicians in the world are not in academia.
Yeah.
They're taking care of patients, and they want to do the very best they can for their patients with what they have. And most of the journals are oriented to people who write papers. The Surgical Neurology International takes papers from all over the world, probably more than any journal in our field. We don't even know where they come from. And so that not, doesn't enter into the judgment. What enters into the judgment is the quality of the work. I agree with Professor Walters on research. I don't think I would mandate that for anything particular. I wouldn't have the government mandate anything. Because basically they can't, they haven't been able to do anything constructive, and we're in terrible situations because of decisions made by politicians. So I think the goal that you should have is to develop your own intelligence, your own ability, your own analytical skills. And no matter what track you take, whether it's a practice or whatever it is, you have to use those skills in everyday life.
I added to Professor Walter's comment there that for those willing to do some form of clinical research, consider this as a story. Tell the story. I saw this patient, I thought about this, and I came like this, and I tried this, and it worked, and I read this paper. And that is basically what any good clinical paper is about, is telling a story, no? A demystification of the actual process of research. And yes, of course, the true researchers, as Professor Walter said, no, those guys know how to do it. But there are stories about patient care, about large number of the patients in a patient care situation that need to be told to guide the research. We think that most of the advancement go from the lab to the bedside, usually go from the bedside to the lab. I've seen this. Can you please, the biochemist and the pharmacologist, explain me to you, and then they go and do it as such. No? But starts from the bedside to the lab.
Professor Jorge, isn't there a problem where that research wouldn't be taken seriously in a sense where it would end up, you know, a person from the neighboring hospital be like, oh, well, you know, this is just a quick report from someone. There's no point in believing this compared to what's now being established as, no, you have to believe the large things.
Yeah, that's right. And usually it takes time. An historical case is the AIDS. AIDS for a long time, and I do remember, was called the 4-H diseases, as the 4 H's, no? Haitian, heroin abuser, homosexual, and hemophilic. And until somebody said, well, but I'm seeing women having this the problem. No. And the New England rejected that paper. No, women are women who do not fail within the 4 H's. And I'm talking about 1986, no? 40 years ago. So, or 38. But the, so yes, there is a dialogue, and there is a stretching. All the boundaries are flexible, no?
Yeah,
right. It's been an absolute privilege, and I'd like to first of all thank everyone. Two points I'd like to quickly make before we close off. One, if everyone could please write to us, especially those who are viewing this recording, because it'll be uploaded, future topics everyone would be interested in and how we can improve on the current session. And if everyone can also wish Professor Walters happy birthday, because he's about to head off to his birthday dinner. And I'll give our panelists an opportunity to give any closing remarks that they may have before we close this session.
Well, I'll start, and thank you very much, both of you, for developing this meeting. And I thank those people for coming. We hope it's been valuable. We're trying this as an experiment to see if we can have communication across disciplines and between generations, which is not common now, about subjects that are controversial. So we hope it's been helpful. We'd like to know how we can do it better. Thank you.
Thank you all. An honor and fun to be talking to you and learning with you and learning from the questions as well. It was fun.
Yeah, actually, I should say that the last point I want to bring before the thank you is that I'm along with the point that popped out by Mohammed about the citation of the research and how it should be considered. Is that good or bad? Or Hassan point about that is it? They take it in account if it's a new thing or not. But I think it depends on your angle of how you view the subject or your duty. I think some people should do very efficient systematic research, and some other people who are more in the practice, they may bring the initial idea. So they should do simple research and report that. I think both of them are evident and should be done together. And I'm very honored to be with this discussion, and thank you.
And I would just like to say, I mean, first, thank you all so much. It's been thoroughly enjoyable. And perhaps to draw our collective attention to the principle of lifelong learning, which underpins medical education. It's a really important principle. I think it's worth mentioning before we close. I'm getting older as we speak. I'm old now and I'm still learning. I've really enjoyed learning from the conversation we've had this evening. And thank you all for joining in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think that's a beautiful segue. Just as Professor Walter says, it's absolutely crucial that lifelong learning, and I guess that's the idea of doing something like this. Everybody's learning from everybody. And again, we'd really like to thank everyone for coming, and hopefully we'll have many more of these to come, and many more thoughtful and interesting discussions from the experts.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Then. Have a better day. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Goodbye then. Thank you.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions or comments to ausman@snidigital.org. Please fill out your evaluation of this SNI Digital session. This program has been supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, owner of SNI and SNI Digital, and by the Waymaster Corporation, producer of The Leading Gen, Silent Majority Speaks, Role Models, and the Medical News Network. Surgical Neurology International and SNI Digital, Innovation in Learning, are helping people throughout the world in 239 countries and territories. Thank you.